And where possible, we would want to, in a safe manner, continue to utilize them. So that's work that is continuing to happen, and we'll have more information on that once we get some additional information from the ministry, and again, depending on which scenario we're in. Lastly, to Chair Johnstone's point, under Section D of 3-3 and cohorting, there is an explanation there around not only cohorting students into cohorts A and B, but perhaps even further subdividing those cohorts. And, you know, in quotations there, there's the notion of bubbling of even a smaller number. All of these are possibilities that, again, we're discussing with public health, and depending on the public health circumstance we find ourselves in, may or may not be necessary.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for that answer. I misunderstood earlier about the bubbling, so I appreciate that clarification. I do have one more question that I'll ask right now, and that's in regards to technology, because I didn't see anything in this package, or maybe I missed it, but regarding technology, and it feels as if we're working under the assumption that all of our technology needs have already been addressed in the past school year. And so I'd like to explore this for a moment. Is that the assumption that we're working under, is that families already have devices and we are going to really need to work on this further, like, we won't need to work on this any further than we already have, maybe just addressing new students to our board?
Associate Director.
Thank you. I'm through the chair. So part of our learning through the school closure period was the number of students who do have access to a device and who do have access to an internet-enabled device, and those students who required a device or an internet-enabled device. And I want to thank particularly Superintendents Denemy and McPherson, who took on this work together with our IIT division to canvas all of our families in terms of accessibility. And as a result of that, and trustees may recall that during the school closure period early on, we deployed a number of devices to families. We were able to secure internet-able devices, and in fact, we still have an adequate supply of devices and internet-enabled devices that can be deployed where needed.
Trustee? Another question follow-up would be, given the unique needs that we couldn't have anticipated months ago when this was brought to program, and really maybe didn't fully understand when it came to us even during COVID restrictions, has there been any work towards acquiring laptops in lieu of tablets for the coming school year?
Associate Director.
I'll begin, and then I'll ask Stacey if there's any other information from an IIT or procurement side. But no, at this time, you know, to my knowledge, we've just continued with the devices that we currently have, which are the iPad devices. But Stacey?
Thank you, Peter, and to the chair. We were looking at piloting in some of our schools the use of laptops, and that was regardless of COVID. So that is something that we will continue to look at. But for making a switch from iPads to laptops, that won't be done without the pilot and the look at the use of the devices and which device best suits the needs of the students based on that pilot.
Okay, thank you very much for that answer. I do wish we had of maybe preemptively made the decision to move towards laptops. Speaking from experience, it was pretty difficult to work on the teeny tiny screen of the tablet in order to get my kids' schoolwork done. Three kids, tablets, very small. It was difficult for them to write out on the screen keyboard. And I think that as we move forward and we're learning from COVID restrictions and what online learning is going to look like, that will be an interesting piece worth exploring. And I think we'll have a chat about it at program in coming months. But with that, I have no further questions.
Thank you. And moving along to Trustee Dango.
Thank you, and thank you to staff for the report. It's comprehensive, and you're working to a certain point in time with the information that you have. So I totally appreciate that, and my questions are mindful of that. My first question is starting out with, we've talked about different scenarios, and in the event that we might need to move to adaptive scenario B or C, what would that event be? What would trigger a shift from B to C, or is that something that we are waiting for direction from the ministry on? Would that be looking at the number of COVID cases in our community, so considering our community context? Would that relate to potential outbreaks in schools? How do we decide when to make that shift, and do we know that at this point?
So I'll turn to the director for this response.
So thank you. From our conversations, Trustee Danko, with the ministry, one of the reasons why they want all three scenarios ready is because they said they're going to continue to monitor the COVID numbers and that there might be regional differences, not just in September, but definitely regional differences that might occur throughout the school year. And those COVID numbers in conjunction with public health, we have to be prepared as a region to transition from one phase to the other. In addition, why they want all three scenarios, they've also indicated that very similar to when we're tracking flu in the flu pandemic, that we always work with public health. So if there is a case, and if there is a situation in school that might require a local school to close with public health direction, then we have to be prepared to transition even maybe potentially a school within our region into another scenario different than the others. So what we've been told is that public health will be a key component of this as we contact trace and to be prepared for all three scenarios across the province, because there might be regional differences or even differences within schools within the region. But what they had said is that they want consistently, and they're going to be providing some templates, and we already are working with public health around this, is around outbreak management, that they want a consistent approach across the province. When someone identifies as being ill, what does each board do at that point in time? And then B, when if that illness is a confirmed case, then the clear process of what we do there. We're working with public health right now, but the ministry is also working with the chief medical officer to ensure that there's consistency across the province with that process.
Thank you. That's really helpful, and happy to hear that we are considering the local context within our region as well as within an individual school or classroom. My next question is around trying to better understand what our classroom will look like in September and how we might transition to scenario B. So I think I'm missing something. If we look at our usual class sizes, I'm assuming from what I've heard that that's what we're going to see in September. So a class of up to 23 for grades 1 to 3, for example. It could be 24 to 26. I hope we go with lower numbers for 4 to 8 and even higher for kindergarten. But then if we were to shift to scenario B and have to cohort students into smaller cohorts of 15, how would we have the teaching staff to do that? I feel like I'm missing a piece here. If you can help me understand that, that would be wonderful.
Associate Director Sovereign.
Thank you, and through the chair, and to your question, Trustee Danko, I'll say right up front that looking at all these different models and scenarios can be wildly confusing. We've done our best in terms of trying to describe them, but if we perhaps go into the report and look at one of the appendices that may help illustrate a scenario B. So 3-20 will bring us to an elementary model. So I'll just give everyone a moment just to look at that. And so if we look at the middle portion where it has a cohort schedule, and in parentheses it says in-school attendance. And so students would first be cohorted, as you indicated, into a cohort A or cohort B. So assuming for illustrative purposes that it was a class of 30, each cohort would consist of 15 students. The in-school attendance piece simply indicates when those students would physically come to school and be in their classroom. However, that class of 30 remains as one class. And so on Monday, when cohort A is attending in person, cohort B is still part of that class, but they're at home learning remotely, connected to their classroom still. And then on Tuesday, when cohort B attends in person, cohort A is at home continuing to learn remotely. Still being part of that one class. As Associate Director Zucker has indicated during the financial implications portion of the report, should we be splitting off those students who are learning remotely from those attending in person, even the small percentage who have indicated that they would continue to learn remotely, there would be a very dramatic financial impact, and above that, there would also be simply the need to find that many more educators. So the model for scenario B does keep classes together. The only difference in terms of the cohorting is who would attend in person. So I hope that provides a little more clarity.
Thank you. Yes, it does. And so what I would understand then is while the students will be in smaller cohorts, the teacher will not. The teacher will be exposed to both class, halves of the class on alternate days. So thank you for clarifying that. On that point, sorry, I've got notes everywhere. What are we doing in terms of class sizes? So, you know, we do sometimes see in our schools that we have classes above the class average, and we are allowed to do that up to a certain number. We did hear from a number of kindergarten parents last year about the class sizes. Are we able to, at the board, consider minimizing class sizes for the grades that don't have a cap, a hard cap?
Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the chair. We've currently undertaken an analysis of how many classes we do have currently that are above 30, and for both elementary and secondary, and have a plan in place for those in terms of the cohorting. I will say the numbers are actually very, very low across the system. And then in terms of elementary schools, trustees will note that we do have a time at the end of September where we do look at school enrollments and we make the necessary adjustments. We do reorganizations based on that. So at this point in time, the plan is to continue with the class organizations as they've been made, class sizes as they've been formulated, continue to look at enrollments and look at student attendance in those early weeks, and if needed, we will look at reorganizing in our usual fashion. So the short answer is right now we are going to maintain the same class structures and then look at potential reorganization at a later time.
Thank you for clarifying that further. Related to that, there is a statement, and I'm trying to find where I made a note of it, that teachers for a given classroom are responsible for the learning for students who choose remote learning that are assigned to their class, and presumably for the AB instruction, if we had to go to adaptive scenario B, they would be responsible for student learning on every second day when they're remote learning. But what about the instruction? Who's responsible for the instruction for the students? Is they responsible for for student learning where they're doing worksheets on their own is one thing. But I noted that if we went to fully remote or in high school when there was remote learning mentioned for one of the scenarios, that explicit direct instruction was captured. So would that not happen in the adaptive scenario B for elementary students on the days they were at home? We wouldn't have direct instruction?
Associate Director?
Thank you, through the Chair. So to your question, Trustee Danko, our expectation would be that classes do remain together. Teacher assignment remains and responsibility for the instruction for those students, whether they are in person or remote, would remain with the assigned teacher. We are going to carefully monitor that and work with our employee groups early on, and we'll have to make a determination as to, depending on the number of students that are continuing to learn only remotely versus those that are in person, the number of staff that we may have who are not able to come into the school due to restrictions but would still be able to teach remotely, and then the staff that we do have that is centrally assigned in terms of any types of reassignment to assist with that direct instruction of the students who are learning remotely. So the answer is yes, the expectation would be that there would still be direct instruction. It would occur during the regular school day, again, maintaining those school routines as best as possible. But we are going to need to monitor this very closely and work with, again, our employee groups in the first few weeks of school to see whether or not we need to reassess that.
Thank you. That does transition great into my next question, which was about staff. So looking at different age groups of our staff, we would have some medically vulnerable people who may be at greater risk if they did come in contact with COVID-19. I understand another board did a poll to find out how many staff would be requesting medical accommodations. Have we done any work with our employee groups or polling staff anonymously to find out what need we will have to replace people who maybe cannot be physically in a classroom due to medical concerns?
I'll begin with that and ask Jamie to provide further update. So Trustee Danko, thank you for the question. There's, as we speak at CODE, and there's also a network of HR superintendents and senior managers that are connecting on this exact topic. So clarity around the one piece, our first guiding principle will be to accommodate people first and foremost. So there are cases prior to this where the staff in our sector who were coming to work during COVID, not teachers, but who were coming to work, who potentially were immune compromised, worked through the process, and there were even some questions about Ministry of Labor and work refusal. Ministry of Labor has clearly indicated that even though there's a pandemic, that automatically doesn't mean that there's a work refusal or that there's an imminent danger. What boards have to do is work through the proper medical documentation, and even if someone is immune compromised, it's not automatically mean, depending on what the situation is, that that they do not have to work or access sick days. But we know there will be cases where people can't. So I'll ask Jamie maybe to speak about the process and the network that HR is involved on this exact topic.
Thank you, and through the chair. Currently, right now, HR staff are a part of a provincial committee that is taking a look at a number of different worker scenarios to ensure that we as a school board and all school boards are fulfilling our duty to accommodate an employee who is may have a need and the need to be accommodated within the workplace. Later this week, Human Resources will send a message to all staff, all employees, to outline our obligation as a school board to support them in preparation for September. We'll outline the process should they require support in terms of preparing to return to a classroom or a school setting in September, who they specifically are to work with. This will be a process in our board which will be led by the team in employee support and wellness. And we'll ensure that we do our very best to accommodate staff to the best of our abilities within the workplace.
Thank you. I know my colleagues have questions as well. I have one last one I'll throw in, and I'll email the rest like Trustee Buck was planning to do. HSR restrictions may impact travel to school for secondary in particular, and if we only have one bell time, I'm a little concerned about how our secondary students will be able to get to school. Have we been in touch with HSR about what restrictions will be in place in terms of number of riders or requirements to ride the HSR?
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair, and I'll begin, and then I'll ask Stacey if she'd like to comment any further. But as part of our review of all our transportation services and considerations for those students who either travel by school board provided bus or cab or HSR, that is all being taken into consideration. Particularly when we've looked at the secondary school times where we realized that we did need to provide a sufficient window of time for students to be able to get back home, particularly if they are riding the HSR. But I'll pass it over to Stacey for anything else.
Thank you, Peter. And I will just say that we are, through the consortium, having those conversations with HSR to make sure that they're aware of our plans and that they can plan accordingly as best as possible. So those are conversations that we're having, and it is something that we've considered. But if we are in an alternative situation, there will be less people traveling on a day-to-day basis. And if we are not, then obviously the numbers will increase to be as the regular number of students that are on the buses on a daily basis. So those are the types of things that we're having conversations with them about as well, but they are being kept in the loop, and we're doing our best to work together.
Thank you so much. I'll just end this with a thanks to staff for the thoughtfulness that's gone into this so far, and I know it's been a lot of work. I hope that we're keeping in mind we need a process for parents to request cohorting. It could be based on bubble needs or high anxiety students or daycare needs, but just going to throw that out there again. But thank you all. I'll turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Trustee Danko. Trustee D.
Thank you. The first one is, this was asked last time, if we're in scenario B, with the students that are at home, when they're at home for half the week, what is going to happen with those students who can't be at home, where they're, you know, whether they have a single parent or their parents aren't home and have to work? Has any more discussion happened around that? Because I know last time it came up around potentially talking to, you know, to rec centers or partners or anyone else, but has any more thought gone into what happens with those students when they're not at school?
Through to the Associate Director, Sovereign.
Thank you, and through the Chair, and thank you for a very thoughtful question, Trustee Deeth. So as we continue to look at the models, particularly the ones where in the adaptive mode or scenario B, we do realize that there are circumstances where if students are not in school and continuing to learn from home because it's not their cohort day, that there may be challenges. And so we are planning on reaching out and doing some work with community partners, but at this time, I don't have any additional updates from the last time.
Trustee Deek?
Thank you. I know it's a huge undertaking, and I do appreciate all the work that's gone into this. My next question is around limiting travel to schools, because we do have staff that do travel from school to school, such as the social workers. You know, we did have resource. I think we have reading specialists, and whether CYCTs. But what about the staff that do travel school to school to support students? Associate Director.
Thank you very much again for that question. I will actually pass this over to Superintendent Nunn, as I know Human Resource Services has been looking at the circumstances where staff do travel from one site to another, as well as occasional staff. So I'll turn it over to Jamie.
Thank you, and through the Chair. Board staff are currently developing a protocol in exactly this regard, where staff may be required to work in multiple school sites. So our protocol would be supported by public health. In situations we're looking at staff using PPE, staff having dividers, if physical distancing is not a possibility when working with a student or a group of students or other adults. We're currently working on that plan for permanent staff who travel between buildings and also to occasional staff.
Trustee?
Thank you. And then just a final question. Is as of March, we suspended or our marked grades stayed as they were. So are we back then as of September fully grading students again? Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the Chair, yes, Trustee Deeth. Unless we were to receive different direction from the Ministry of Education, we are certainly proceeding with the new school year, with again instruction, assessment, and evaluation, and reporting based on our current practices, and not the ones that were put in place during the closure.
So, which is going to be, I guess, a challenge because, as you know, I guess depending on the scenario, if we're back to either scenario B or C. We know there's students that struggle with that at-home learning. So it's, I know there's not answers to all these questions, but I would obviously there's gonna, as you said, we're learning to build the plane as we fly it. But I would be interested because you know I think we're gonna have to do some concessions for some of these students. You know I don't agree in suspending marks or not marking. Obviously we have to do that, but it's definitely gonna be a challenge. I think that's it for my questions for now. Again, you know, thank you. I know this is a massive undertaking and really appreciate all the work that staff is doing. So thank you.
Thank you, Trustee Deese. Moving on to Trustee Galindo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just building off Trustee Danko's comments, I appreciate how thorough this update has been, especially around some of the questions that trustees asked 2 weeks ago at our last special board meeting. I see that there's now language around ventilation and the development of an outbreak protocol. I think I would certainly be in support of a motion to request that an update be offered to trustees every month in the new school year. So that's something that I would certainly support. Trustee Bigham, Archer, and Danko have already asked most of my questions, so I have two remaining questions. So the first one, I remain concerned with the financial implications of this pandemic. For me, the cost is secondary when it comes to guaranteeing the safety and well-being of our students and staff. That being said, $2.1 million for the upcoming year is certainly an unprecedented cost. That works out to be about $210,000 per month and doesn't even include the cost of hiring occasional teachers should we offer remote learning. So I'm wondering if I can get clarification on any financial assistance that we can expect to receive from the Ministry of Education prior to the start of the school year. I mean, this is certainly above what our $1 million contingency fund was for. So I'm wondering if I could just get some clarification on that.
Before I just pass this over to Stacey, I'll just comment that on the call with the minister today, he did suggest that update would be coming this week or next, but he was hinting more towards this week with a financial update because he was asked multiple times today about the finances. So I'll leave you with that, but I'll turn to Stacey for additional details, please. The Associate Director, Ziegler.
Thank you, and Chair. As Trustee Galindo indicated, the total cost is the $2.1 million. Again, that's our best estimate at this time based on the information we have and the pricing that we have. As we work through the pricing with the ministry purchasing for us, that number would go down. As trustees know by now, when I provide numbers, it's usually the most conservative estimates. And as I indicated, some of it has already been purchased and will go against the 2019-20 budget, which we had savings related to COVID. So those savings would be offset by some of these expenses to prepare for next year. And then in addition, as the chair indicated, there is the possibility that we've been hearing of funding that will be coming from the ministry. The initial funding that the ministry announced was about $4 million for the entire province, which our share is usually 2.5%. So we were looking at about $100,000. Obviously, that wouldn't get us very far with the cost that you're seeing in front of you. So we are hoping that there is additional funding that we will be receiving, and we should hear about that within the next couple of weeks. At the same time, when we initially had our budget, we set it with a $1 million contingency. Then after we passed the budget and got the actual information, if trustees will recall, there's about another just under $1 million that would be added to the contingency. So our contingency for 2020-21 is approximately $2 million. So this obviously wouldn't be the only cost, but it is something that trustees did indicate that we could use the contingency for. So we would expect right now that between some of the costs being charged to this year, additional funding coming from the province, and then the remainder coming from the contingency, that although it is a large and unexpected cost and something that isn't easy for our board to swallow, it is something that we will be able to overcome.
Trustee?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with that answer, I certainly get the indication that our priority and the priority of staff is safety first. And being that the financial implications section is only two small paragraphs, I'm happy to see that is the focus, that we're focusing on safety first, cost secondary. So that's good. Thank you for that. My second question, changing gears a bit, is with regards to the outbreak protocol. So this question is more for the director. Is the director prepared to close a school or multiple schools for safety reasons in the event of an outbreak? That's the question that parents will be asking as soon as someone tests positive at a school. And what criteria will public health be using to define an outbreak at one of our schools? I imagine that they're developing guidelines by which the director could be using for making a decision as to whether or not to close the school for safety reasons. I also understand that the director just touched on that a bit with responding to one of Trustee Dankle's questions earlier, but I'm wondering if I could get maybe a specific response to that school closure question. And I do have a third question, sorry.
And just before we move along to that question, Trustee Galindo, if you turn to Appendix G, which is page 3-24, you will actually have a breakdown of all of the finances, just because you had stated that there was only a few paragraphs on the finances. There is a whole supplementary under Appendix G. And for anyone that may be listening to our board meeting, trustees just got this report today, and as mentioned, it's hot off the press because we
thank you for sharing
information to the last minute. So with that, to the director around preparedness to take action in the event of an emergency or an outbreak. Thank you. Director, I think you're on mute.
Oh, thank you. Through the chair. So to Trustee Galindo's question, important question. So what the trustees have provided me, which I have, is a policy that highlights inclement weather and board cancellations. And one of the guiding principles there is always to make decisions based on a safety experience and staff. So, and then there is a long procedure here that outlines the procedures for canceling, not only due to transportation, but if there's an interruption in service, if there's extreme temperature. So there is a procedure that I would, or City of Hamilton emergency. So under that section, emergency could be deemed in terms of a outbreak in a class or in a school, and then we would be working with public health. So the current policy and procedure allows me as the director to operationalize something. And, of course, I would give that as part of an update to trustees, but that would always be in consultation with public health around emergency like a pandemic.
Trustee Galindo, further follow-up?
Yeah, and I think like many things, we're probably awaiting ministry direction and clarification, as well as, you know, we're currently working with our partners at Hamilton Public Health Services to perhaps get a clear idea on that, what that protocol is going to look like if someone does test positive. So thank you for that answer. My final question is with regards to supply teachers. I think it was touched upon earlier, but it wasn't made clear to me at the time. Normally, supply teachers work within multiple schools. I guess it is going to be a challenge to fill vacancies if someone is away sick for hopefully non-COVID-19 related reasons, but I'm wondering if we can get some clarification perhaps from an HR perspective on that.
And just a reminder to folks to put yourselves on mute, but to Associate Director Sovereign.
Thank you, and to the chair, I'm actually going to pass this question over to Superintendent Nunn again.
Thank you, and to the chair, we've currently been hiring for our elementary and secondary occasional teachers and our educational workers for occasional positions this fall. We currently have not put any parameters at this time around occasional staff working at a specific site or group of sites within a family of schools. That is one protocol that we're currently working on with public health and seeking some guidance from them.
Jesse?
That answers my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And with that, we're moving down the roll call list to Trustee Maria Felix Miller.
Trustee.
Left.
Hi. So I have a few questions. The first is, I was really happy to see the breakdown of some of the signage that we're going to be installing both at schools, just our buildings. That's really wonderful to see. I think it's going to be very helpful for kids, particularly younger children. But I was actually also wondering, do we have plans to send sort of like a welcome back brochure or an info kit? I know it'll probably be accessible via online means, but I'm wondering if it's within our capacity to send an actual brochure out to families, both so kids can get familiar with what the signs say, if they can't read, and what they look like, but also so that parents can kind of have that discussion around the dinner table, helping students get kind of used to the rules, getting used to, you know, practicing hand washing, practicing sneezing accordingly, you know, kind of hammering home the idea of around, you know, bring your own water bottle, all of those things. And I'm wondering if the ad hoc committees had entertained that idea.
Associate Director Sovereign.
Thank you, and through the chair for the question. So our communications and community relations manager, Sean McKillop, is working on whether or not a direct distribution, how we might be able to do that beyond just posting on our website. But I will direct trustees to two aspects in the report. One is in the section where we talk about students requiring special education supports and services. There is a section there that does talk about transitions and the importance of working with families during this time in transitioning students back. And beyond that, we are working on similar type of transitional resources for families in preparing students to return to school. So sort of in connection to, you know, what might these signs look like, but a little more broader than that in terms of getting having that readiness back to school. But as I said, Sean will continue to look at whether or not being able to provide anything in a more print format to families is something that we can do prior to the beginning of school.
Trustee Miller?
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. I will keep watching for any updates around that. Just another question. I wanted, if I could, a clarification. I believe Associate Director Zucker mentioned I think extra staff at a cost of approximately $28 million. Was that extra staff for distance learning, like occasional teachers, potential? Kathy?
Joined.
Associate Director?
Yes, that was that would be the cost if we were to keep all of the students in the original classes, but if they weren't going to be coming to class into the physical environment, that would be the cost of providing occasional teachers to provide the distance learning. So there would be options, and one of them, as we talked about, was reorganization. And again, reorganization, if we were to do that and say if there were four grade one classes in the school and we moved it to three grade one classes and then one online grade one class, it would be very difficult to be able to have a fluid movement of students between in person to remote learning back in person, or as the ministry changes So the choice would be taken away from parents, but also when the ministry changes direction, it would be very difficult also for students. So the cost is only one of the things that prohibits that model. It was provided for information. It's not the direction that the board is looking to go. It was just to show that we have looked at it and that that is how much it would cost us to be able to do that.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to say this plainly because as trustees Danko and Galindo mentioned earlier, I'm missing something here because I just cannot wrap my head around how an instructor or an educator is supposed to provide in-person learning for a full school day within the context of making sure class, bodies in their class are washing hands, wiping things down, managing bathroom breaks appropriately, the physical and mental health components that are going to go along with being back in the classroom, and trying to figure out where 15 to 30 children are, who will be at varying degrees depending on how, you know, what type of learners they are, where they dropped off on the map last year. That in and of itself is going to be a feat. I don't know how they're also supposed to provide direct instruction via distance learning during the school day. It's impossible to me as far as I can understand it at the current moment. And this is nothing against any of the work that the staff has worked on, because this to me is just literally an impossible question. I do not see how a single instructor is supposed to pull all of these things off and provide continuous, thoughtful, expertise teaching. While I respect the dedication to making sure that we're keeping students within a single cohort and trying to make any future transitions less difficult, I really do not see how we're going to provide adequate instruction across the board without more staff. And the reality is that I know those numbers sound really big, but we need help from the province at this point. We need help from the ministry at this point. And I appreciate very much the work that the staff is doing, but I am worried that we keep trying to find answers where there are no answers. If there's no answer for, you can't split a teacher into three or two. So I'm wondering whether, I just don't know. I respect that that's where you've been told to, those are the scenarios that we've been told that we have to work within. But I believe that at this point, we do need to take a stronger stance, that we need substantially more funding. I will get to a question. I'm sorry. I need to explain that because I literally don't understand how this is going to work. I also have some very, very significant reservations around the $2 million from our contingency funds. I know that we got that number because our staff is fantastic, and last year you did an amazing job with the budget. But again, this is another area where we happen to have $2 million. The bill that I saw, or sorry, the total, you know, is 2.1 on our projections currently. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's the potential going to be if we can't cover any more? We're still going to need, you know, reparations on our school buildings, updates, all of the other different various things that we use our contingency budget for every single year. And I guess I'm looking to just even around the table to hear whether or not people are feeling comfortable with okaying some of these directions. I will also ask, and I don't know if this is going to be an appropriate question, but in the event that we are in scenario B with the 15 and 15 for the two cohorts with alternating days, are staff going to be wearing full PPE in a scenario like that?
So I just, because you had a couple of different things in there, Chucky.
Sorry, I apologize. So, that was a bit of a lot. But
I do want to. So at our last meeting 2 weeks ago, I had said to trustees that we were going to write a letter. Part of that letter was around the finances. I have held off issuing it simply because I was waiting to get the finances from this week. So that, I guess from, to answer that question around finances, that was discussed at the last table in terms of a need for more funding. So,
that's wonderful. I am very concerned that staff are working incredibly hard, but the answer will not come, unfortunately, unless we are able to resolve funding. So thank you. That can just be, I'm happy to have my hesitation sort of recorded and for us to come back to that discussion.
And then what was the last question that you had a very specific question,
so,
and then
so in the event that we're in scenario B, where we're dealing with the alternating days and a split class, two cohorts within the same umbrella class, are educators and are staff going to be required to, like, what's their PPE going to be for that scenario?
Okay. So I'll turn to Associate Director Zucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just reiterate again that the $2.1 million is our best conservative estimate as to the cost for the entire 2021 year related to COVID expenses. It would come from savings in 2019-20 for anything that we've ordered and get delivered before the end of the year. It would come from hopefully additional funding to be announced from the ministry. That we're waiting for an announcement within the next 2 weeks. And then we're also, for anything else that would be left over that those two sources of funding didn't cover, then we would look to our contingency. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear when I stated it. And then as far as PPE goes, as we've mentioned, we are waiting for direction from the ministry. Currently, we have ordered for all of our school-based staff, so that does include classroom teachers and includes teachers that are moving in between. It includes our ECEs, our EAs, anybody who's in and out of the school. We would have the face shields and then the disposable medical-grade masks two per day, plus we would be purchasing extras for occasional staff as well. So right now, that's the direction that we're hearing, and that's what we have been purchasing. If there were to be additional PPE required or additional direction from the ministry or from public health, then we would be looking to purchase those as well. We do have to purchase within the next week or two to make sure that we have everything available for the first day of school. So it is important that we get that direction from the ministry soon, and it is something the ministry is aware of.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you. And thank you for clarifying the financials portion of it. That is clearer to me now. My question is,
around specifically whether or not instructors in class are going to be wearing the shields. Because one of my concerns that I have around scenario B is, you know, 15 children in on Monday, Wednesday, another group in on Tuesday, Thursday. My concern there is if one of the children in one of those, you know, in either the Monday, Wednesday or the Thursday, Tuesday, Thursday class, if they are carrying, you know, if they're sick, you've exposed the instructor potentially, and then in that case, we might as well be in a full, a regular Monday to Friday scenario. So I appreciate you clarifying exactly what the PPE is going to be, and I know we are waiting on specifics from the ministry right now as well. But I'm wondering whether or not we're inadvertently going to be exposing, and at that point we might as well